Thank you, and welcome to the Enlightenment Center conference call. I want to thank you for taking the time out of your schedule tonight to join us. It's a wonderful day this Thursday, and we want to thank you once again for coming in tonight. Tonight, we have a very special guest with us tonight, one that really needs no introduction. He resides in Reno, Nevada. His name is Dr. Stephen Harefield, and he is the author of The Metaphysical Interpretation of the Bible. Dr. Harefield is actually has written a book, and this book that he has written answers the mysteries of the Bible and how to master oneself. It's based on 37 years of thorough research that led him all over the world. It is based on historical and metaphysical facts that includes missing books that were originally included in the Bible. It is a journey of mastership, empowering, and while achieving an inner divine nature. Dr. Harefield owned the talent Spirit has given him, learning many healing techniques, and he became a relic master and the techniques of focus and energy for higher purpose. He now teaches the techniques to his students and audiences throughout the world. Dr. Harefield continues his writing, counseling, his lecture, and workshop tours. He has even released two CDs. The first is Seven Essence Mirrors of Relationship, and the second is The Power of Thought. There are also many of his seminars that are available as downloads from his website, which is Harefield, H-A-I-R-F-I-E-L-D, Harefield.com. And so on tonight, we have a very special guest, Dr. Harefield. How are you doing?
You know what? I'm doing absolutely wonderful, and it's my pleasure to be here with you and your group, without question and without hesitation.
Dr. Harefield, I one, being a metaphysician myself, studying metaphysics, have first been drawn to metaphysics by being a student in Unity, by religious science, and one of the books that I first came upon was a book called The Hidden Meanings of the Bible by John Addington. Mm-hmm. And it was a wonderful book, how it really enlightened me on how to decode the Bible. What I want to ask you tonight, and we can discuss, explain to us why is it important to go through and study the metaphysical interpretation of the Bible?
Well, the first thing I would suggest, Jonathan, is for your audience this evening is in essence this, that all theologians, all theology from the Catholic Church through any Protestant faith, all of the traditions and the teachers of those traditions would tell you that the Bible is metaphorical and allegorical. And the religious sector, not that I'm against or for them, but the religious sector, more times than not, tends to take the Bible and uses it for convenience. But if the Bible itself is metaphorical and allegorical, then what does it actually tell us? And for myself, what began my journey in actuality, and all sincerity, Jonathan, was a horrendous childhood. I had a dad that was... well, to put it mildly, it was interesting. But what it did was set my feet on a search for meaning. And I knew as a child, and I love to share with people that I'm a recovering Catholic, that I knew when I was sitting in the church that there was something different being offered than what was being said. And when I began my search, little did I know that I would find out sometimes I could say more than I wanted to know. And the only reason I suggest that, Jonathan, is simply because, it's been an uphill fight, if you will, to get people to realize there's a different understanding of the messages of the one that we term as the Christ, or who I refer to as the Master, than what they're being interpreted into. Christ never wanted or desired to create a church. And one of the things that I discovered, here I am in India and Nepal, and my very first teacher, without going through all the details, said to me that you are here to learn of Isha. And I said to him, who is Isha? And he said, he is the one that you know as Jesus. He was here. I was shocked. I went, what do you mean he was here? He was here to learn. Became fascinated that day and in that second. What was he there for? What was he there to learn? And since that time, back in the early 70s, Jonathan, I've done every bit of research that I absolutely and implicitly could in the idea of this person. Who was he? What did he do? What did he study? And through my understanding of it is, in essence, he said that everyone could be just like him, and here's how you do it. And what I did with a metaphysical interpretation of the Bible is took what the Vedic text said. Vedic texts, by the way, are the oldest, if you could call it, religious texts known in the entire world. And I began to research those, the sutras from Buddha. And then I began to study the Middle Eastern text of the Nag Hammadi and the Dead Sea Scrolls. These texts were left out by the original biblical scholars as, so to speak, unworthy. And the reason they were construed as unworthy is there was no power and control wrapped within them. And as the Bible began to evolve, it began to evolve in the notion and idea of power and control. Christ himself, just simply as an example, said that a house divided cannot stand against itself. What does that mean? Well, okay. For a moment here, we can say a house divided. Okay, we have a God and we have a devil. Whoa, we have a heaven and we have a hell. And to my early mind, I was going, wait a minute, these are division. These are the creation of division. And through my research, here's what was discovered, just as a sampling, and maybe we can get into a conversation about it. What I discovered in the ancient text actually described the Satan as the ego, or lower attribute of human ideas or ideals or human consciousness. The higher ideal is brought on by focusing the mind to higher ideas or attributes of human, which is what the idea of Christ discovered, found, and brought forth. And what the churches themselves do not wish us as individual humans to know. Come on, do we need a church? No. Do we need a higher ideal? Yes. Those are without question. I hope I'm making sense for you, Jonathan, am I?
Yeah, it makes total sense, total sense. I'm in total agreement with you.
Good. And what has happened is the churches and the dogmatic approach that they take have led us away from the higher ideal through the notion of guilt. Most people don't realize, Jonathan, that through the formation of the Bible, especially during the period that we call the Inquisition, over 10 million people were persecuted, tortured, and literally destroyed because they did not go along with the ideas of the fledgling Catholic Church. The interesting thing about those people, and how do we know that number in the first place? Pope John Paul, 1996, gave a speech asking for forgiveness of the tortures perpetrated on humankind. So we have Pope John Paul that said, hey, we did this. They never said why. But out of that 10 million people, well over half were women. In other words, the idea that the Catholic Church was perpetrating was cutting God in half, turning God into a man, and we today still refer to God as a male. Well, excuse me, everybody, let's look in the book of Genesis. In the very first, latter part of the first chapter of Genesis, it gives us these words: let us create human, both male and female, in our image and in our likeness. All right, first you got to ask yourself, okay, who's we, who's our, who's us? Because that's a multiplicity of ideas. What the Creator was actually suggesting to us was the fact that it itself resided in two energy points, a feminine and a masculine. And what the Creator did is create both male and female. We can even take that further, Jonathan. We can take that into the idea of the soul is feminine, form is masculine. Emotion is feminine, mind is masculine. We can even take that further into night is feminine, day is masculine, water is feminine, land is masculine, and we can go on and on. My point is we see those and those two attributes only in any direction that we look. So when we look at the idea of creation, we're talking about two sources of energy, two poles, two polarities, in the creation of masculine form or human. Through that, we now have life as what we know today. There are, in essence, two poles of a battery, a negative pole, a positive pole. One represents masculine, one represents feminine. There's the creation of human form. When we look at the idea of God as male, we're actually cutting it in half or reducing it to half a life, which is how we've lived in the Catholic Church, the original Church, which is the creation of religion. That was its purpose, was to gain control over human form through the idea of threat and persecution. And we have forgotten what the true creator is. Christ, the embodiment of that, was balanced masculine feminine form. And it came in to demonstrate that idea and ideal to us. Now you got to ask yourself another question. Wait a minute. Jesus came in to cleanse us of our sins. Did he really? Because if that were true, why did he give his life? How can I say that? That sounds blasphemous. Is it really? Here's why that's being suggested. If Christ came in to forgive our sins, then he gave his life for nothing. Because the sins he supposedly came in to free us of, we have since perpetrated upon each other. So therefore, his life was for naught, at least in that context. So what did he do? The idea behind the Christ is a simple one, very simplistic in its nature. His message was, very simply put, you can rise above the flesh, and here's what you do. You give yourself to life, you rise into spirit, and through that idea, you overcome the pull of the flesh into the higher dynamics of the birth of the divine in physical form. You with me?
Yeah, I'm with you.
Good. Any questions that I can answer for you? Any direction you'd like to go?
Well, basically, I'm understanding what you're saying about the whole, you know, dealing with the religion and how we looked at Jesus supposedly coming to save man from his sins and so forth. How would you then explain why it is important for one to understand the Bible metaphysically as opposed to the general masses that read the Bible literally?
Well, when we look at the Bible in a literal context, Jonathan, it's more based on physicality and physical nature, which physical nature is more about power and control. When we look at physical life and the early idea of the churches, I mean, goodness sakes, they could threaten you with not only all of your wealth, which, by the way, people tend to overlook the fact that the early churches also were the tax gatherers for all the kingdoms and fiefdoms, which meant, they were the money gatherers. Not only were they money gatherers, they began to threaten them with the loss of their soul, not only with their land and their money, and that they would have to become repentant or they would burn in the idea of hell forever. The interesting thing about those illusions is they stuck with us. So when we look at the idea of the Bible is almost, Jonathan, it's like almost every book that's ever been written in the notion of good against evil. But when we look at those two notions, those are humanistic. Why do I say humanistic? That's actually simple. Because when I say humanistic, we have created God in our image and in our likeness as opposed to the original intention, which is us being created in the Creator's likeness and its intention. We've shifted it. And you can find that in so many different directions and in so many different places globally. Here's a classic example. If I were to say to you, do you know what YHWH means?
YHWH.
Right. It's the original intention of the idea of Yahweh, Yebeheh. the ineffable name of the idea of God. Interestingly enough, there are no vowels in YHWH. The point is you can't say it, and the point of that is it was never meant to be physical, and once it was turned into Yevhe, it became physical in a physical external context. What religion would have us believe is the fact that God created reality, and after it created reality, it went, ooh, gross. This is the grossest thing I've ever done. I'm not going to touch it. I'm out of here. In other words, God's an external thing. So you see, where I come from in a metaphysical interpretation of the Bible is suggesting, as Christ himself stated in Matthew 5, that you look here and you look there for the kingdom of heaven. Do you yet not know that it is within you? Well, hello, if it is within you and God is in heaven, guess where that places God? Within you and within I. It's not a thing we have to search for. It is a thing for us to be. Let me ask you a question, if I might, Jonathan, and it's something I pose in a metaphysical interpretation of the Bible. If you were this thing that we term as the Creator, this thing that we today reference as God, which shortchanges it because it's more encompassing than that, that if you were this thing that we call God, and you wanted, as the Bible specifically states, you wanted your creation to be just like you, that would mean one thing and one thing only. For them to become like you, that would mean they would have to search. For human to search, that would mean you as the Creator would have to hide something to create the search. You with me?
Yeah, I'm with you.
Okay. So if you were to hide this thing to bring your creation to your realization, the question would be, how would you do it and where would you put it? And here's the answer. You would make it so simple that no one would believe it. Not only that, you would have the audacity as the Creator to put it in plain sight. In other words, it would be so simple that no one would ever see it. And here's how we can arrive at that. Christ himself said, also in the book of Matthew, these words, twice, that you must have the mind of the child to enter the kingdom, that you must have the innocence of the child to enter the kingdom. Both of those, are, to myself, are very specific, that through the innocence of your own being, you can see the creation of life in your very own self, because it is you and I already, the human. We are the creative principle in physical form. We are the living rendition and the idea and ideal of what all of us seek. And as long as we seek outside ourselves, that we will never find. Why? Simple. Because we already have and are what we seek. You know, Jonathan, I spent many years in the Far East in India as a monk. Studying the different ancient texts of our world because I wanted to know the truth. And when we look at the Sermon on the Mount, it has seven simple basic principles, one of which we've interpreted to mean in the sense of those that are, those that seek righteousness will see the kingdom. Well, you know, in ancient Aramaic, that's a two-edged sword, because the idea of righteousness can also mean truth. So let's insert the word truth as opposed to righteousness. Those that seek truth shall see the kingdom. That takes it out of the realm of the religious dogmatic approach. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
So once we establish the idea of seek truth, in other words, your eyes will be opened, you will become illuminated, you will realize the understanding that you seek. So, if God's not outside you, it is within you, because we know that God is in heaven. Christ said, the kingdom of heaven is within you. So that now means, what are you looking for? So anyway, when I'm in the Far East, one of my teachers asked me one day, he said, young man, what do you seek? And I told him, I wanted to be like Buddha. I wanted to be like the Christ. I wanted to help humanity. I wanted to give them consciousness and understanding. And he smiled and he looked at me and said, well, young man, that you will never achieve. and go, "What? Why am I here?" He looked at me and smiled, and he said these words: "As long as you seek a thing, you will never have what you seek, because in the seeking, it means you do not have what you wish to have."
Yes, sir.
But once you stop seeking, then you have the very idea that you have sought. And I have found that, my friend, to be absolutely implicitly correct.
And you are absolutely 100% correct.
And that's exactly what Christ told us. You already have what you seek. That put me in the direction that I walk today, to bring that level of knowledge to people. You are already. See, here's the other thing. And correct me if I'm wrong. You're a minister.
Yes.
Christ himself said, "You shall not worship idols." Correct?
Correct.
All right. What have we done to Christ?
We have worshipped him.
But haven't we created an idol out of him?
Yes.
All right. So if we've created an idol, now does that not go against what he himself said?
You're absolutely right.
All right. Not only that, we have put this thing that we call God on an unreachable pedestal. So it also is now unreachable and or unattainable. Yet in reality, when you really read the text, there's one thing for sure that I can tell you, which the Bible in and of itself specifically states, that Christ was not for churches. He was against them. And the Bible itself says that. And I realize that's very bold on my part to even throw that out there. But when you read the Bible, that's exactly what he was about. And you have to read the entire text to glean that message. But it is as blatant as you and I.
When you're looking at the Bible, I heard the stories that there are over 100 or 200 virgin births, and that we all know the stories that before Jesus, there were many masters that had the same story as Jesus. I actually began to study a book that was called The Greatest Story Ever Sold. I don't know if you're familiar with that book.
Yes, I am.
And,
I love it.
That book began to enlighten me on the whole concept of the church and Jesus, and understanding that before him, there was the same stories that kept going on throughout the civilizations of time.
Yes,
and when I began to understand that and came into the knowing of what this whole concept of what Jesus and what the church is, I actually made a statement that everything that I thought was real is really fake, and all the stuff that I thought was fake is really real. And when it comes to that enlightenment, that concept of truth, when you embrace truth and are awakened to it, once your mind expands, it can never go back to the same place that it has first been expanded to. And when you come into that concept of understanding, just like you said, that which we seek, we will never have. I understand
correct.
And know that the only thing that I get out of life is what I become.
That
I have
correct.
To become the exact thing that I want to have.
Yes.
What I want to talk about right now is I want you to delve into the Gospels of the Bible, and I want you to show me and explain to me metaphysically what is the true meaning of the Gospels.
A beautiful question. First off, before I begin that, just one thing. In fact, there are 256 references to a virgin birth, 256, one of which is accepted as reality and as truth. The idea in ancient language of the notion, if you will, forgive the word, a virgin simply means young person. That's all. Nothing more, nothing less. So Mary, in essence, was a young lady. A virgin? Who knows? Only she and Joseph would know. But if you look into Judaic history, if she had a child out of wedlock, she would have been stoned by the Judaic people themselves, and Joseph would have never married her, period, because of the superstitious times. I mean, a lot of people have to understand that. Virgin just simply means young person. You with me?
I'm with you.
All right, I just wanted to address that. All right, the Gospels. The Gospels are, I'm an individual that believes in the idea of no coincidence, no accident, that everything absolutely happens for a reason.
Exactly.
So when we look at the four Gospels, why, out of the thousands of books, did they select these four Gospels. You have to understand, too, when they were choosing the four Gospels, there were some criteria that was outlined at the Council of Nicaea, ordained, if you will, by Emperor Constantine, that they had to meet certain criteria. One, they had to be all male. Two, they had to be direct disciples or apostles to Jesus. Well, guess what? Two of them aren't. That's Luke and Mark. Those two were not direct disciples of the one that we term as the Christ. Absolutely were not. When you look in the book of, interestingly enough, Luke, and you look in, I believe it's the Gospel of Mark, you have all 12 disciples' names listed. And interestingly enough, two of them are not there. They are. Mark and Luke. They're not members or direct apostles. Now, when you go back into ancient translation, and this is what I'm about to offer is a little bit of a mind-boggler at first, but I'm going to get there. When you look at ancient translation, when they translated, simply as an example, the book of John, they translated the book in this manner. It went to a person named Junius. The actual name was Junia. Junius is John. Junia, Jonathan. That's feminine. It basically means that the book of John may not have been written by a man. We're talking text manipulation. The other thing I've got to share with the listeners is this, that when they chose the idea behind the apostles being male, had to be a direct disciple of Jesus, they left out so many texts. But interestingly enough, the original Bible is actually formed out of four basic religious precepts of the early world. Mercianites, Ebionites, Thomasines, and Gnostics. Most of what we read in the Gospel is Gnostic. In fact, in specific, Luke and John are Gnostic texts. The founder of the Gnostic path is Mary Magdalene. The founder of the Thomasines and India today, Christianity, which is in India, is Thomasine. It's based on Thomas, not Jesus. Also a Gnostic. And when you read the books of Luke and John, they are Gnostic traditions. When you read the book of Matthew, it's Marcion. And when you read the book of Mark, it's Ebionite. That's where the fire and brimstone all comes from, is those two factions. Interestingly enough, also, the four Gospels, here's what they represent. When you read it, and you have to read it very closely to glean the interpretation, the book of Matthew represents physical life, physical birth, physical reality, and what your experience is going to be during that reality. The book of Mark is what you're going to experience and what you're going to do and have and be persecuted through in the physical sense of the word. Or Mark is mental, excuse me. Matthew is physical. Mark is mental. Luke is emotional. John is spiritual. You with me?
Yeah, I'm with you.
Okay, I hope that just made sense for everybody, not to confuse them. When you read the text, once more I would share with you this. Matthew, physical self. Mark, mental self. Luke, emotional self and experience. John, spiritual attainment, spiritual reality, spiritual wherewithal. Pure, simple in their context. It is the journey of consciousness. It is the journey of enlightenment. It is the journey of being. It's the journey of self-discovery, which is what the Bible is about. It's so amazing to me. It's the alignment between the Vedic text and the Buddhist sutras. Let me give you an example of that, if I might. In the Buddhist sutras, Buddha predated the Christ by 500 years. The Buddhists evolved the idea of karma and karmic law. The very first principle of karma, based in the sutras, by Buddha. The great law, or the first or prime law of karma, is what you sow, so shall you reap. One of the points brought out by the Christ is what you sow, so shall you reap. He didn't think that up. He was taught that. In fact, in one of my segments in my book on a metaphysical interpretation of the Bible is the 18 missing years of Jesus and where he was and what he was doing. Guess what? He was in the Far East. He was studying the sutras, the Vedic texts. He was studying the Brahmanic texts. In fact, he was almost killed and crucified in India for teaching those texts to the masses, just the way it occurred in Israel. So when we talk about the Gospels, we're talking about us as the human and our experience. And in my book, I relate to each individual how that relates to them as an individual and what their experience is going to be as related by the Master, the Christ, the one known as the Christ. He was taught, as my point. He was attempting to share with us what he found out and discovered and what he knew to give us the path, the way, the understanding, as he absolutely articulated in the biblical text. I am the path. I am the way. I am the shepherd. I am the light. All of those are actually very ancient meditations leading the individuals to that level of higher consciousness. So we could literally state that if you understand the interpretations of the biblical text, that you would become an enlightened being. You would achieve your own personal Christ consciousness, which is available to us all.
Now, I have a question that I growing up in a Baptist church, Pentecostal churches, and so forth, we hear all the time about Jesus is coming back, the rapture. We look into the book of Revelations about the great war of Armageddon and so forth. Mm-hmm. Does Revelation refer to the end times, or what exactly does the book of Revelation in fact mean metaphysically?
Excellent question, Jonathan. Is it the end times? No. What is being suggested in Revelation and the idea of the Christ is our awakening to that level. Can I take a little bit of a circuitous route? Do we have time?
Sure, we have time. We got an hour, Doc.
Okay.
We got time.
All right. This is going to be a little bit mind-bending, but we've heard the theoretical idea of it before, and that's the fact that Mary Magdalene and the Christ had children. In fact, they had three. First being Sarah, Boaz was the second, his son, and the third daughter escapes my mind at the moment. But let's suppose, theoretically, that that's true. It's just conjecture, because who has the birth certificates? If that were true, and that was 2,000 years ago, and because of the interrelationships and intermarrying that's been going on globally, I mean, we see Africans marrying Caucasians. We see Caucasians marrying a Mac. Look at Tiger Woods. His mother is Thai. His dad was African-American. Look at Mariah Carey. In other words, we're seeing intermingling is my point, and which is the original intention. Now, if Christ and Mary Magdalene did have children, guess whose genes through 2,000 years are floating around globally? Wow.
Jesus and Mary Magdalene.
Yes, sir. And guess what maybe the intention was? Just maybe, this is a postulation, that we were all to arrive at that destiny in our lives. And Revelations is saying you are going to shed your physical notions. You are going to shed the lower dynamics. Your genetic makeup is contained within you, and you are going to awaken to this. What a reality. Imagine, Jonathan, a world filled with people with Christ consciousness. Now, that may sound absolutely nuts to everybody listening, but let me document this for you now. The idea of the end times, wouldn't that make the Creator somewhat of a joke? Why? Because what astrophysics and all of physics tells us is there is an idea called infinity. Infinity is an idea or a notion where there's no end. If there is one end or one answer anywhere, then that means that the idea of infinity is an illusion and or a joke. Well, we know simply by looking into the cosmos, that's not true, that there is an idea of infinite. Now, if the idea of infinite is true, then that means the idea of infinity is everywhere, which now means there cannot be an end time. But what it could mean is a birth into a higher dynamic, going back now to the postulation of Christ and Mary Magdalene, seeding the planet with higher consciousness. Then that means that we haven't gotten there yet, and the idea of revelation, according to the four Gospels, and the union of revelation along with the four Gospels, we are in the creation of that idea as we speak. So we are to be rebirthed into a higher dynamic, living in the higher idea of the Christ consciousness itself. All right, now, wait a minute, Stephen. There's the idea of the Antichrist. Okay. What is the Antichrist? And here's something I love about documentaries, and it's a simple notion. They always say that Antichrist is coming. They always share with us that this thing is real and is going to, in essence, destroy us all. Okay. Now, if there's a God and we are like the Creator, would you destroy your own children? I would have to believe that that answer is no. So what does that mean? When we go back and we look at the idea of creation, if the Creator didn't create equally, wouldn't that make it a joke?
Yeah.
Okay. And if the Creator creates equally, wouldn't it create equal to its own self, or wouldn't that make it a joke?
Okay.
All right, I see you didn't buy into that yet. All right, but the point is, are we equal to the Creator? Sooner or later, we're going to be, and to myself, that's the idea of revelation and the postulations thrown in revelation. How can I say that? Okay, and all the specials that come out there, they talk about this thing called Antichrist, right?
Yeah.
Okay, in the idea of Antichrist, what we have is, in actuality, an indication of a calculation. How can I say that? In Revelation, here's the exact wording, which no special documentary ever states it in a literal context. It literally states in Revelation, let those with the ability to calculate the number of the beast is 666. Okay, hang on. Wait a second. And everybody out there listening, you check it out, because that's exactly what it says. Let those with the ability calculate the number of the beast. Now, in ancient times, we know through historical documentation, ancient peoples were very much into the idea, if you will, of numerology. What is numerology? It's taking any multiples of numbers and reducing them to a single digit. A single digit in this context would now mean 666 is 18, but reducing it to a single digit would mean adding the 8 in the 1 of the 18, making it a 9. You with me?
I'm with you, Doc.
All right. 9 means end of cycle.
Okay.
End of a phase. Now, I'm going to diverge for a moment in one other direction. I've also spent much time studying the Mesoamerican or Mayan text in Central America, and we see the notion or the idea of 2012.
Okay, I was just getting ready to ask you about that.
Okay, good. 2012, when we look at the ancient Maya text, we see Quetzalcoatl descending into darkness. What archaeology has done is they've indicated that that was something that was going to occur, and Revelation says this is going to occur. Well, I got news for everybody. My understanding is this, that Quetzalcoatl, 3,500 years ago, descended into darkness, which now means we're going to ascend into the light. And interestingly enough, when you read the last chapter of Revelation, my heavens, it says, there we are, ascending into light, where no darkness shall ever be found. So what's Revelation telling us? That we're going from the pull of the flesh into the higher idea and ideal of consciousness, into full-blown knowledge of all things. And the book actually tells us that. So now when we tie all of this together, and by the way, I'm a fan of old Bibles. I collect them. And my oldest Bible is 1817, but when I wrote Metaphysical Interpretation of the Bible, I used an 1837 version of King James. And in that 1837 version, in the book of Revelation, it says something different than modern Bibles. Our modern Bible, which was actually created in 1901, are you ready for that? 1901, some almost 2,000 years after the birth of the Christ and his transition, so to speak, it says in the newer Bibles, do not harm a hair on the head of those that have the seal of God on their forehead. And in the older Bibles, it says, do not harm a hair on the head of those that have the seal of God in their forehead. Excuse me, but there's a very distinct difference between that translation.
Exactly.
In means the intuitive sense, the guiding light of higher consciousness. On is being captivated and captured by physical reality. In the early translators, it made no sense. Well, I should say the later translators, not the early translators, because the early translators wrote it literal. In the future generations of translation, they took the metaphor and turned it into fact because they couldn't understand the idea of in their forehead versus on their forehead, so they put it on their forehead. Now, excuse me, one transposition of characters makes one huge difference. You with me?
Yeah, I'm with you.
Okay. So the idea of Revelation is not so much about end times as it is about ascending to our own higher divine consciousness, which is what we were all born to achieve in the first place. When we look at all the ancient texts, what we see here is a lowering of humankind into physicality and a raising of humankind. What I found in my search and research over the last 37 years is this is cyclic. Do you know in the Bible, as an example, Jonathan, it says, Christ says that, and I love the wording, and in that time, the ground will be so hot that you shall not be able to walk on it with your bare feet. So what does that mean? Hey, how about the illusion of global warming?
Okay.
I think we have a hint. Is it global warming? No. My point is yes, we are in that time. We are in that time of transition, and only those that are able to achieve higher consciousness or will be the ones that will achieve it. I love the series of Left Behind. Forgive me for the way that I'm going to say this. But in the Left Behind series, a lot of Christians are going to be shocked when they're left behind. Why? Because it's not about whether you externally believe in God. It's about, do you live in your Christ consciousness and your higher consciousness? And here's the idea behind that. When we look in Revelation once more, and we look at the notion of the Antichrist, is it an individual or is it collective consciousness? Anything that goes against the higher divine mind would be construed as Antichrist, would it not?
Yes.
Now let's look at the idea of the fundamentalist religions, all of them. don't they go against the teachings of the Christ? And if that's the case, aren't they indeed anti-Christ?
Okay, you're right.
All right, and I believe completely that that's what they teach. You cannot be this. Sri Ramakrishna in India once said that if you repeat enough that you're a sinner, then you soon will be. We are taught from the moment we're born that you're born in sin, there's nothing you can do about it, and you're going to die in sin. There's no growth there. There's no ability to change your lower consciousness into higher consciousness, yet Christ himself differed with that. He said, yes, you can do it this way, and this shall be given you. Everything that you read metaphorically in the biblical text says that you can. Let's look at the rich man that approached the Christ and said, how can I enter the kingdom? And Christ said, give up all that you have and follow me. And he said, oh, man, I can't do that. That's like too much. You're asking me way too much here, Bubba. Can't do that. And Christ said, okay, so be it. Well, that was a simple choice, but the message was, give up your grip on physical reality. He didn't say you can't have wealth. That's not what he said. He said, what's important to you? Is the lower idea of self important to you, or is the higher ideal important to you? If it's the higher ideal, then you can reach that level and in that kingdom. If it's lower ideal and you're stuck on the notion of, how's my hair? How do I look? How's my bank account? What do they think of me? What does this person think of me? You're stuck. That's the message that he actually gave that day. And that's the message that most people overlook. Why do people go to these churches in the first place? So they can be seen. And we all know what Christ had to say about that. He even said in Matthew that when you pray on the corners, you pray to be seen. But when you pray, and this is in Matthew 5, you go into your inner chamber and you do it in secret. And when you go into these churches, you're doing it so that you can be seen. There's no sacredness. There's no sacred consciousness to that. That's ego. That's lower self. That's what he meant when he talked to the guy about his wealth and the need of giving that up. It wasn't necessarily about only money. And the Bible isn't about money.
You're absolutely right. Now, we're just getting ready to come into the closing minutes here. But what I wanted to ask you, if there is somebody on this phone call tonight who's wavering between coming into metaphysics, one foot in, one foot out, somebody who's even not into metaphysics, somebody just listening, just wants to listen and is interested in what we just talked about tonight, what would you tell them?
I would say, first, bless you, that you are awakening to the higher idea of yourself, that if you really, truly ever want to find the divine, then you must look within you. Buddha said that. The Christ said that. It's nothing outside you. If you allow the external world to create your happiness, if you're tired of living in fear and you'd like to live in joy and in the idea of bliss and consciousness and understanding, then look within for the love sought. Because in the outer world, love is used as a weapon. And if the divine creator is the true divine creator, then it is within you. Our eyes, interestingly enough, are placed on the front of our face. Placed on the front of our face, it means it wants us to see where we go. That doesn't mean living in the future. It means living in your present. So my suggestion to you, the true seeker of truth, and the higher ideal of being is to first accept yourself as not broken. Accept yourself in the real sense that you were created in divine perfection. Because if you cannot do that, then what you're doing is you're actually saying to the Creator that it made a mistake in the creation of you. And if the Creator is the epitome of divine perfection, then it created you in the same context. And it's your judgment of you that blocks you from seeing the divine nature of your own self. And if you ever wish to find the divine, you can only find that through your own eyes and through your own being and your own journey in this reality and life. And that's the path of acceptance of you as the unique creation of the Creator, producing divine perfection. That's what I would say, Jonathan.
All right. Dr. Herfield, how can our listeners
purchase your book? How can they purchase your book and find out about your lectures and what's going on?
Okay. First off, you can, of course, barnesandnoble.com. You can go to, of course, amazon.com. And I'm going to be genuine with you. If you'd like to save yourself a few nickels, you can go to Hairfield. That's www.hairfield.com. And you get a 33% discount, or excuse me, a 15% discount on the book, which is probably the best idea that you're going to get, I'm going to tell you. It's 808 pages, and it goes from Genesis all the way through Revelation, and it covers every idea that the Creator ever wanted us to understand. If you wish to contact me directly, I am welcome to that. I actually have many Christians that communicate with me online over the book, and it's amazing at their acceptance of it. When I say Christians, I'm talking fundamentalists, and I'm okay with that because that means growth. You can email me at stephen@hairfield.com, and or here's my phone number. You can call me at area code 775-826-5999. And I'm always open to talk with anyone on any subject. I'm not into judgment. I'm not into condemnation. I'm into the path of acceptance, which is what the Christ, the Master himself, stood for, is that path of acceptance. And nothing intended. I hear it's a great book, but candidly, I've never read it.
Tell us a little bit about your trip you got coming up.
Hey, thanks. I take people once a year to India. And we leave on October the 11th, and we return after three glorious weeks on November the 1st. We leave from San Francisco. You can find out the full details of that trip if you go to my website and just click on the icon that says Retreats, and you'll get a full description of it. I mean, imagine riding a camel for over an hour in the northern deserts of India at sunset, or on the back of an elephant, or taking yoga while you're listening to the sound of peacocks, or working with Ayurvedic physicians. And I'm one of the people that actually, the prime person, I would say, that I basically give people monk 101 over those 3 weeks on the journey to enlightenment. We talk about Shiva. We talk about Gautama Buddha. We talk about the Christ, and we visit and talk with priests and monks at many different temples. You also, it's a physical, mental, and emotional detoxification, which leads you to a higher conscious self. And you know what's interesting and why I take people to India, Jonathan, is because I spent 6 years of my life over there as a monk almost, and I learned more in that country and how to celebrate life than you could ever learn in this part of the world. So if anybody is interested in the idea of consciousness, you check out the journey. And the price that you see may seem pricey, but it's not. And here's why. Everything is included. Your round-trip airfare from San Francisco, a layover in either Singapore, Seoul, or Taipei, Taiwan of a full day, which includes a tour there. It includes all of your meals. It includes all the sightseeing, all the yoga, all the classes, all your meals, and all of your hotel rooms. And by gosh, you stay in 400- and 500-year-old palaces.
Yeah, that's amazing. For those that are listening that definitely want to get into his trip, definitely check out his website, hairfield.com. Also, I'm definitely going to get a copy of his book, The Metaphysical Interpretations of the Bible. I think anybody that's even into metaphysics that calls himself a metaphysician, this is a must-have in your library. And I want to thank you, Dr. Hairfield, for tonight. It was a phenomenal discussion. I was very enlightened on some of the things you touched upon tonight, and we want to thank you. You will be a guest with us again for sure. This is not your last time being with us. I want to tell those that are listening tonight that if you need to contact us, you can contact us at theenlightenmentcenter.net. Ask that those are listening to definitely go to our website and sign up for our newsletter. We send out a weekly newsletter. Sign up. We keep you informed of many things that we got coming up, many different features and so forth that we're doing. We want to keep you informed, and we understand that we want you to be a part of us, because at the Enlightenment Center, that's where dreams come true. And so you can also email us at theenlightenmentcenter@gmail.net. and also I'm sorry, at gmail.com. The Enlightenment Center @gmail.com. Definitely go to the website. We have a whole bunch of information. You definitely be informed. Don't forget to check out Dr. Harefield's website. He's a great metaphysician doctor. You can also watch him. He has a lecture on Google Video. It's about a half an hour, 33 minutes video clip of him preaching at a Unity church. And so we definitely want to keep in contact with him, some of his audio CDs and so forth. As you can tell, he's a well-versed, well-informed man, great knowledge and wisdom. And so here at the Enlightenment Center, that's what we do. We take knowledge in and we enlighten ourselves. And so I want to encourage all those tonight that are listening to know this one thing, that your destiny is not a matter of chance, but it's a matter of choice. And I want to thank you for tuning in. Thank you. Good night.